Welcome to the RRM, where we discuss topics related to restorative reproductive medicine, or RRM. I'm Emily Kennedy, a certified fertility educator and health coach with Reply Fertility. Today, we welcome Lily Nichols, a registered dietitian nutritionist, a certified diabetes educator, and author of three fabulous books, Real Food for Fertility, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, and Real Food for Pregnancy. Lily, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And I want to get started with your most important claim about what you eat that can be summed up in two words, real food. What is real food? Why is that so important?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me. There's all sorts of different definitions out there for real food. For me, I'm looking at foods that have not been processed in a way that is removing the nutritional content. So this goes beyond, I think everybody can agree, refined sugars can be problematic, or refined carbohydrates, where you have white flour, which once was a whole kernel of wheat that's been processed. Of course, you're removing nutrients and fiber in the process, but a lot of people don't expand beyond that to think about animal foods, for example. You know, when a chicken lays an egg, it has a yolk. Once you've taken that yolk out, if you're only consuming the egg whites, it's not that egg whites are necessarily a processed food or are harmful to your health, but you're not getting the complete nutritional package if you're not also consuming the yolk. You can expand that to dairy that naturally has fat, to the steak that naturally has fatty streaks in it, to fish that naturally has fat in it, to nuts that naturally have fat in it. I mean, we're at a point where people have like peanut butter, defatted peanut powder instead of peanut butter, right? So you just have to be aware that if you are processing things to remove parts from the whole because maybe a certain nutrient has been deemed harmful, whether or not that's actually true, you're getting a different nutrient intake as a result. So when I'm looking at real food, I'm not only looking at, is it a food that it has nutritional benefits to it, but does it have all the parts of the whole still present? So your body is getting the full complement of nutrients that it is supposed to get from that food.
I completely follow you. You want the whole parts. And you've touched on some of my favorite foods, which are whole eggs and full fat dairy. It's a great segue into, and I see you've got the original artwork, which I know you've done yourself for your book behind you. I think it's just fascinating that you majored in nutrition like myself. And so we were both deep into chemistry. And then to give yourself a break from the chemistry, you did all the original artwork because you minored in art for the cover of your pictures. So behind you, you have an inspiring depiction of really, what is that? Why don't you describe for our audience what is in the frame behind you?
That's a hatching blastocyst. So it's a fertilized egg going on to the next stages of embryonic development. We wanted to have a depiction on the cover that made people think of fertility. And it gets a little bit tricky because a lot of the images are kind of overused, like a sperm fertilizing an egg, and some of it overlaps with pregnancy. And we wanted something that would elicit that without being something that's been completely overused. So yeah, it's just a watercolor painting of the very earliest stages of human life.
It's absolutely beautiful. And it's a great segue into, well, egg quality is a bit of a buzzword in the fertility world. And there are lots of things that are trending for egg quality in terms of supplements and even diet regimes. Can you speak a little bit about some of the trends you're noticing and like what's your opinion of them in terms of egg quality? What is even egg quality?
So egg quality is referring to how robust a human egg cell is, how they can measure it. If you're undergoing assisted reproductive technology, you can look at various aspects under the microscope to measure egg quality. But essentially, it's like how a good quality egg would be one that would have best chances of being fertilized and developing into an embryo and implanting into the uterine wall and actually growing into a human. Egg quality is a bit tricky because unlike with sperm, you can very easily get a sperm sample, but with eggs, you kind of can't. So a lot of times we're looking at indirect measures like laboratory markers for egg quality. But essentially, like better quality eggs, you have a better chance of conception, a lower risk of miscarriage or early pregnancy loss, lower risk of pregnancy complications. So if we can take steps to optimize egg quality, we're improving your chances of conception and carrying to term. It's hard to even speak of all of the various opinions on how we improve egg quality, because fertility is a bit of a black hole with information on the internet. I mean, you have people from all different dietary camps claiming that their diet is the best diet. Ultimately, I try to like divorce myself from the various fads or labels, because you kind of miss the bigger picture when you're labeling everything as, oh, we do this plant-based and this vegan and this keto. And it's like, we have to come back to the basics. Like, we support optimal egg quality by supporting the overall nutritional foundation of the woman herself. And if we're optimizing her hormone levels and we're seeing that reflected in her menstrual cycle parameters with regular ovulation and sufficient but not too long amount of time between each cycle and cervical fluid quality, all of these things, then we're also supporting egg quality. So, I mean, some of the foundational things would be getting a consistent and optimal amount of protein. A lot of our dietary recommendations on protein are too low. I mean, the RDA is set at like a bare minimum level, and we see optimal egg quality, optimal ovulatory function with higher protein intake. And you want to have that protein coming in from a large variety of foods, not just plant foods, but also animal foods as well. So you're getting the full complement of all the amino acids. There's some really, really interesting research on some specific amino acids that are only found in animal foods, such as L-carnitine or taurine or creatine, that are really beneficial to egg quality. We also want to not obsessively take the fat out of all of our protein-rich foods, because if you're not consuming enough fat, you have low hormone levels. And we know this because they actually did trials back in the 90s. They were trying to see, could we prevent breast cancer from developing in women by suppressing their estrogen levels? And you can do that very reliably with a low-fat diet. You keep the fat too low, especially saturated fat and cholesterol, and then you are essentially removing the component that all of your sex steroid hormones are built on, which is cholesterol. So you see a drop in estrogen and progesterone levels actually when you put women on a low-fat diet, pretty substantially too, like a 20 to 50% drop. So that's going to also impact egg quality. You're going to stunt follicular development if you're not getting enough fat in the diet. So again, we kind of come zoom back out, and we're looking at getting an optimal amount of protein and not taking all the fat out of everything. And then there's a huge role for just keeping oxidative stress at bay. So like, can we keep inflammation levels down? And there's a number of ways that we can do that. Keeping our blood sugar in a healthy range is a huge one. So keeping the ultra processed foods, the refined carbohydrates, the white flour foods at minimum, and getting your carbs from whole foods naturally helps with reducing inflammation. With those foods, you're also getting all of the antioxidant nutrients intact in those foods. So there's, of course, a place for plant foods here as well. Your fresh fruits and vegetables and your legumes, those are all really beneficial for keeping inflammation at bay and providing antioxidants. They also provide us with fiber. So once your body has created hormones and processed them, and some of them have kind of done their job and are used up and are ready to be recycled and parts of them excreted from your body, you do that with the help of your liver. And once your liver has done all that work, and by the way, your liver needs a lot of protein as well as many different nutrients like selenium to help that process, then they're excreted into your stool. And if you don't have fiber coming in your GI tract, then you're not binding that excess used up estrogen and carrying it out of your body. So this is why you need a balance of the plant and animal foods. So I'm trying to like keep it kind of zoomed out so people actually have something useful to take from this versus like, here's this study on XYZ antioxidant and egg quality, because ultimately your egg quality is a reflection of your foundational health.
Yeah. And I personally love the studies. I could spend a whole 20 minutes looking at one specific study, but I do really like your answer to the question, like all the trends out there, what people find on social media. That's great. It's good to be aware of, but really what you have to come back to is, are you eating whole unprocessed foods? Because that will kill so many birds with one stone, one takeaway, and you can nod your head in agreement if I got this right for our audience, is quiet the diet. Come back to cooking. Okay, you have some fabulous recipes that I've tried and enjoyed for my family in your book. I love how your meal plans have no portion sizes. You just say, eat until you're satisfied, because it's important for women to quiet that diet. You've probably seen this if you ever were in private practice as a nutritionist, as a dietitian, right? The diet mentality needs to go away, and you need to come back to enjoying cooking whole unprocessed foods, and you will just quell that inflammation, manage your blood sugar better, and without even trying too hard and having more fun, more flavor in the process, improving egg quality, improving ovulation, which is one focus of restorative reproductive medicine, improving cervical fluid, which is another focus of restorative reproductive medicine. Is that a good takeaway?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we can kind of simplify a lot of this. And it's a bit ironic because I feel like when you're saying anything that's counter the mainstream narrative on nutrition, you really have to, or it's my choice to back up my statements with the literature. So there's a lot of sites, there's over 2,000 citations in Real Food for Fertility alone, because there's just a lot of unraveling of this old dietary dogma in there. And we're also up against very popular trend of plant-based diets, or this sort of Western misinterpretation of a Mediterranean diet, essentially a low animal food diet. And yet when you're in practice, as you're talking about in clinical practice, you can see how these trends work out in real life, separate from whatever research is going on. And there's issues with how some of those research studies are designed. That's a whole topic for another day. But you can see how it plays out. And what I am hearing consistently from clinicians, and then what I have seen in my own practice, is that as you drop animal food intake too low, we see problems with hormone production. And oftentimes these women are at risk for hypothalamic amenorrhea if they get too restrictive, especially too restrictive on their protein and fat intake. So we need a balance, right? And it's hard for a lot of people to find that equilibrium. But I like to give people the suggestions on the foods and combinations, and then let them kind of find their happy place with portion size. Because I don't know if you're somebody who needs 1,800 calories or 2,500 calories or 3,500 calories. I mean, we have elite athletes who need so many more calories than the general population, and they're at very high risk for fertility issues if they're under consuming. So I'd be doing a disservice to give a meal plan with insufficient calories for somebody that needs a lot more. So I like to just kind of leave it a bit more open-ended for people to customize to their own needs.
Yeah, those are all great points. The focus on, you know, we're talking about macronutrients, getting enough protein, getting enough fats, but really it's kind of a catch-22, because we don't want women really tracking and obsessing about certain grams of things. Ultimately, it's about being nourished from an unprocessed diet pattern, right? Not falling prey to the trends that are out there, products that you feel you have to have, be they supplements or powders. Getting back to what our ancestors used to do, which was cook with their families if possible, and sit down and have a meal together and feel nourished, not just by the food that we prepared for ourselves, but nourished by the company that we keep. I'd be remiss, though, and I do see your point with how it is so much easier to assess sperm quality. I do also know that the literature for sperm quality, the parameters do need an update. They've been several decades. The reference ranges for normal sperm are several decades old. Can we touch a little bit? Because one of the most fascinating points in your book for me was how sperm quality impacts placentation, which is the development of the placenta, a whole new organ that the pregnant woman grows in the first trimester of pregnancy. Can you dive into a layperson explanation of that? How does that work?
So the placenta is formed from embryonic tissue, so it has the DNA from both parents, and it just so happens that the placenta more strongly expresses paternal DNA than maternal. It has both, but the placenta really is taking a lot more cues from paternal DNA, aka men's sperm quality. So there's been some pretty interesting research looking at preeclampsia, for example, with sperm quality. You can have a man who's been with multiple, had children with multiple women, and all of their pregnancies were complicated by preeclampsia, even though those women may have had children before or after being with this partner where they did not have preeclamptic pregnancies. It's very interesting. So yeah, there's some data suggesting up to 13% of preeclampsia cases are solely due to sperm quality issues. So the placenta is developing pretty early on in pregnancy. It's happening in the first trimester up to maybe in the early part of the second trimester. And depending on how well that placenta forms and how well it, the term sounds scary, but invades the endometrial wall, like you need it to have really strong vascular attachment so that you're having good blood flow between mom and baby. If that is not well formed, then you can run into a higher risk of pregnancy issues. And many of these complications end up showing up later in the pregnancy. You kind of don't know there's an issue early on until it shows up down the road. So a fair number, they call them deep placentation issues. A fair number of pregnancy complications can go all the way back to an issue with placental development. So you need both, right? You need a healthy mom. You need the endometrium to be healthy, sufficiently thick, and receptive to implantation and placental formation. But you also need healthy sperm quality as well, not just for like the healthy transcription of the genetics of the baby, but also for the formation of the placenta. So we do need to bring men into the conversation a lot more. The sperm quality guidelines, as you alluded to, I'd really highly recommend people check the sperm quality chapter of Real Food for Fertility, because we go in really specifically on how those parameters have changed over time. And they have reset the goalposts, but they keep resetting the goalposts lower every time they revise the sperm quality guidelines. And that just reflects the population-wide decline in sperm quality over the decades. So yeah, it's a bit tricky. There's a lot. It's kind of a rabbit hole, that whole topic.
It deserves a whole podcast. And I am definitely, as a boy mom, very interested, always interested in keeping my sons healthy, and then thinking about investing in future generations by investing in the proper nutrition of our guys, the guys in our life. Really, you know, it sounds so onerous, right? But it does still come down to what we talked about for egg quality, cervical fluid, endometrial thickness. It still comes down to the same recommendations for the guys, does it not? And at a very high level, you're still looking at getting them back to eating whole, unprocessed foods instead of relying on this, that, and the other trendy product, correct?
Yeah, the overarching theme is similar across men and women. Obviously, men are going to need a lot more food. They're going to need more protein than women. You similarly don't want to overly restrict fat. Once fat drops below about 40% of calories, you have a decrease in testosterone production. Again, a lot of similar things apply. I think since it's so much easier to measure sperm quality, we have a lot more robust data on nutrient levels improving sperm quality than we do egg quality. And so you could say for some nutrients like zinc and selenium, for example, we might have even more data on its importance for men. But the overarching theme of whole unprocessed foods, adequate protein and fat, a variety of fresh foods, avoiding toxins like cigarette smoking, alcohol, focusing on higher quality carbs versus the refined stuff, like this, those things all still apply to the man as well. So you don't need to be cooking separate meals for your partner. Like if you're doing something for improving your own fertility, you can do the same essentially for your partner. There may just be slight differences, maybe on a supplement protocol. They're not necessarily going to be the same.
Absolutely. And supplements is another topic I think you could devote a whole podcast to. But to sum up here, as we work with couples in restorative reproductive medicine and try to help them achieve natural conception, what would be, like, how would you help a couple to prioritize? And I know this could be highly individual, but let's just say we're coming in as a couple and we've had a long journey. Maybe failed IVF, failed IUI, several years. We're like on the verge of just like, ugh, do we just even keep trying? Let's try this RRM approach. For a couple like that, and you can imagine just the emotional stress that they've been through it and are still in, what would be your top recommendations? What would be your key things that they should get started on?
So some of that might come down to the lab work that you have on them, and hopefully there's some comprehensive micronutrient testing going on, but just from like a general perspective, a high quality, comprehensive prenatal or multivitamin, and yes, those also exist for men, a high quality multi for men, would cover most of their micronutrient bases. There may be some additional areas that you need to supplement extra depending on their blood work, but that covers a lot. A lot of people are coming in nutrient deficient. You would think in a developed country where we have access to all sorts of food, we are not seeing those issues, but we are. Like, at least half of adults have at least one micronutrient deficiency. Most have multiple. So that would cover a lot of the bases. I would definitely be checking vitamin D levels, as that plays a significant role in both sperm quality and egg quality, and supplementing extra if needed, or encouraging regular sun exposure and testing your levels to see that your sun exposure is adequate to keep your D levels in a healthy range. The data on vitamin D is extremely robust, so that would be a big one I wouldn't skip. Omega-3 supplementation has a place if someone's not consuming a sufficient amount of seafood, and most people are not. So some form of marine oil, it can be an algae-based DHA if you don't consume fish, but I really highly, highly encourage people to include some seafood in their diet, because you're getting a lot more than just the omega-3s. I'll just leave it at that. There's a whole big section on seafood and real food for fertility. I would also most of the time need to add in a magnesium supplement. The food supply is pretty depleted, and a lot of people are not hitting the mark for magnesium, especially when you have somebody who is struggling to keep their vitamin D levels up. You need magnesium for many of the different stages of metabolizing vitamin D. And so if they're deficient in magnesium and you're not seeing their levels come up with vitamin D supplementation, that's probably a missing component. There's many, many more supplements that you could potentially add in. I think those are some of the major ones, but there's a time and a place for certain antioxidant nutrients for both men and women. There's certain supplements that can help with blood sugar if that's an issue with either partner. So I do recommend customizing with a professional if you can. There's a whole chapter on supplements and real food for fertility, but there's still like nothing compares to working one-on-one with a provider who can actually test and measure things and give you more specific guidance.
Thank you for that. And so to start off with a provider who can order the correct labs and interpret them, give you a customized approach to supplementation, starting with vitamin D, omega-3s, right, the essential fats, and magnesium would be a good place to start. And this is how I work with supplements. I try to get the couple to think about how, and studies have supported this, people who take supplements, the action of just taking the supplement, regardless of whether it's just a broad multivitamin or a specific nutrient, cues them to other healthier habits, like drinking more water or going for a walk between meetings, or including a salad or some of that delicious seafood that we're fans of, for zinc in particular. So hopefully the action of adding that pill, that nutraceutical, as I like to term it, is also going to get them thinking about, I need to do other healthy things, as opposed to, you know, the pitfall, which you're probably aware of, which is like, well, I've already done this, so I don't need to eat the food source of that nutrient.
Yeah, I mean, I do recommend people approach supplements from the standpoint of they are there to supplement. I mean, it's literally in the name. The diet, not replace a healthy diet. Nutrition is really a young science in the grand scheme of things, and we're still identifying nutrients that maybe we didn't know whether they were important or questioned whether they were essential. Do you really need a dietary source of this, or can your body just manufacture enough? And like choline is a great example of this. I mean, our first recommended intake levels for that nutrient were in 1998. That's when it was identified as an essential nutrient. It was assumed that, well, your body can manufacture choline, so we don't actually need a source of it in the diet. And they designed trials where they exposed men to choline-depleted diets, and reliably, it caused, and I don't use the word cause very often, it caused fatty liver disease. And now we're seeing it's skyrocketing rates of fatty liver disease. There's many reasons for that beyond just choline deficiency, but 90%+ of Americans are not consuming enough choline.
And it's just amazing. It's four eggs. Okay, that's another thing that I took away from your book. Of course, you can also search the food databases for nutrient levels, but the dietary allowance, the daily allowance for choline, is it not just four whole eggs, including the yolks?
Approximately, it might be a little more.
Depending on the egg.
Depending on the size of the egg and then whether you're pregnant or breastfeeding, the levels go up during those stages. And then we have research that's questioning whether the adequate intake level is actually adequate. So some research is saying, oh, actually, you need like more than double what the recommended intake level is set at. But yeah, approximately having a couple eggs a day, if you tolerate eggs, is something I do highly encourage for many different nutrients, choline being one of the main ones. And that is reliably the most choline-rich food in Americans' diets. It explains over half of choline that's consumed in the U.S. So I do highly encourage them if you tolerate them. Yeah.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, this is just amazing information. And again, I'm looking forward to booking you again to dive deeper into parameters of a healthy cycle, maybe more into supplements and men's health. But for now, I think that we're going to wrap. This has been an awesome episode of the RM podcast. And if you're out there and you're thinking, well, I'm really interested in what restorative reproductive medicine has to offer me, check out replyfertility.com. We are an alternative to IVF. We boast 50% pregnancy rate within 1 year at one-third to half the cost of IVF. So replyfertility.com. And definitely check out Real Food for Fertility. Our author, Lily Nichols, is here with us today. And I look forward to inviting you back to continue this conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
To ask questions about RRM or to learn more about restorative reproductive medicine, you can contact us at replyfertility.com/podcast. Keep up to date about RRM by following us on your favorite podcast or social platform. All the links are in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the RRM podcast, and we'll see you next time.